recount efforts as well. And I'm going to start out our session this morning by talking about how U.S. elections can be vulnerable to cyber attack. What have we learned through computer science research, through security research, through the efforts of the election integrity community about some of the threats in this space? And then what do we need to do as a country to mitigate them? So why are elections a hard security problem? Well, they're hard in part because of the massive scale involved. We're talking about an enterprise involving hundreds of millions of registered voters, voting in hundreds of thousands of precincts, in more than 10,000 jurisdictions across the country. It's a highly distributed enterprise. The American ideal of election administration is to push as much of the work to the local level as possible, and this is a great idea in any kind of large and distributed organization. But on the other hand, that means that there are many things that can go wrong or can be deviated from procedure at the state and local levels that can lead to problems. As a computer scientist, I also would say that the system is sensitive to latency. That just means that we want to know the results of elections right away. We don't want to wait a month to know who's going to be president. And so we need a system that's going to give us returns on election night. And unlike many other countries where they have a simple ballot design, maybe one question, which party will represent you in parliament, something like that, our conception of democracy in America is that we're going to vote on a lot of different questions. And you have places in the country that have ballots that run 6-8 pages long, sometimes longer. We have a lot of races. We have a lot of candidates. For these reasons, all of these different kinds of complexity emphasize the reasons why we end up turning to computers to vote in American elections, right? Because counting 6-page ballots on election night in 187,000 precincts is something we haven't found the organizational capacity to do. I'm not saying it's impossible. It's just a really hard problem. So we turn to computer voting machines. And across the country, the decisions about what technology to use are made by individual states, sometimes by individual counties or even smaller units within states. All of this complexity of implementing the computer technology itself is something that becomes a diffuse and distributed problem across the country. But what technology do the states turn to? Well, there are 52 different models of voting machines across the country, I've counted, that were used in 2016. But they really fall into just two categories. They're either optical scan machines, like you see on the left, which many of you may be familiar with. The voter fills out a piece of paper, passes it through a scanner that's sitting on top of a ballot box. That scanner tells you right after the polls close how many votes were counted for each candidate. The other style is what is called DRE voting, or direct recording electronic. This means that the voter interacts with a computer instead of a piece of paper, and that computer in its electronic memory contains the primary record of the vote. Some of them print out a record of that vote that the voter can briefly see that gets stored. This is called a VVPAT, or voter verifiable paper audit trail. But in any case, both styles of machines are fundamentally producing their election night counts using computer hardware and software. All right, so the question, are these machines secure? This has fascinated me for more than 10 years now. This is an area where I've been in my research with my group in the university. We do studies where we acquire a voting machine, maybe government surplus, analyze it in the laboratory, and tell the public what we find. But it wasn't always easy to do this. So back 10 years ago when I started, the voting machine manufacturers were extremely resistant to any kind of external testing of their systems. And the first time that any research group in the country was able to bring one of these machines into the lab was when my group, I was a PhD student finishing up at Princeton at the time, was contacted by an anonymous source who gave us one of these machines to study. This is the Diebold AccuVote TS, and it was at the time the most widely used machine in the country. By the way, Georgia voted with these machines statewide earlier this year. They're still in use. So what did we find? We took the machine apart, analyzed the hardware, learned how it worked. It's basically just a system like your laptop in a fancy case. And we also took apart the software. And what we found was pretty disturbing. So what we found was that the software in the machine, like most computer software, this isn't surprising, has different kinds of vulnerabilities, some gaps in the security protections, where if the data that's being fed into the machine is manipulated by an attacker, the attacker can cause the machine to behave a different way. They can infect the machine with vote-stealing code. Now, with these machines, like most voting machines, they have to be programmed before every election with the ballot design, the names of the candidates, the races. And that programming is copied into the machine with a removable memory card, basically like a digital camera. If we, this is what we actually built with our machine in the lab, if we infect the memory card with malicious software, and that memory card is put into the machine before the election, we can permanently infect the machine with malicious software and cause it to behave dishonestly, to shift votes for whatever candidate we want. And in our machine, we did a mock election between George Washington and Benedict Arnold, the traitor of the Revolution. And, of course, everyone always votes for George Washington. But on our machine, no matter how many votes George gets, Benedict Arnold always wins. And there's no other sign that anything bad is going on. The machine is just running our secret software in the background invisibly. So this is one machine, right? There are 52 different kinds. But what do we know about the rest? Well, since that time 10 years ago when we studied the AccuVote TS, my group, other groups, groups commissioned by states have studied many, many different kinds of voting machines across the country, both the optical scanners and the DREs. And in every single case, without exception, machines that have been subjected to this kind of rigorous security review have been found to have vulnerabilities that would allow the insertion of vote-stealing malicious software. Without exception. All right, so that's the individual machines. But how do you, hacking one machine, all right, that maybe that's possible, but could you really affect the results of a national election? So let's think about ways that that could be done. One category of ways that someone could try to attack our democracy with a cyber attack is different kinds of attacks that would be disruptive but highly visible, like altering the results that are reported on election night by hacking into TV networks or the AP feed or something like that. Attackers reportedly tried to do this in Ukraine in 2014 and to cause them to report the wrong results. But in Ukraine, it was caught at the last minute and stopped. And in the U.S., it would probably be caught, if not right before, then eventually, because states do reconcile the reports that each precinct makes with the overall results that are reported on election night. You have to change the votes within the machines and within the precincts in order to have an undetectable effect. Another possibility would be denial of service attacks, just causing the machines to fail on election day, or causing the electronic poll books, the registration data, to be corrupted. That kind of disruption, sabotage essentially, could be targeted at particular locations that tend to vote for one party, one candidate, or another. So it could have a partisan effect. But it would look like chaos on the ground. That could have a political effect, could undermine our democracy, but at least we know something was weird. And political interference is another potential category of attack in this way, and something that in 2016 we've heard a lot of discussion about. Fake news or what have you. This is outside the scope of what I want to talk about today, but it's also a deeply important topic. But what about trying to invisibly alter election results? So hacking individual machines at a wide enough scale to try to tip the balance. Can that be done? Well, there are three challenges to an attacker who wants to change national results. The first is the diversity and decentralization of our election system, right? It should be hard to attack 52 different kinds of machines. Well, you might say that, but that's actually not quite a disadvantage in a close election. In a close election, the results are going to depend on probably just a few swing states that are going to be predictable in advance. An attacker can identify those swing states from polling data, try to probe all of them for weaknesses, and this you can do in an automated fashion, and then target the states that are most weakly protected. So, in fact, the diversity of our system sometimes is good. There's not one central place to attack to change national results, but in close elections, turns out to be a diversity of strength and weakness, and the attacker gets to choose where they'll strike. So the second challenge is that the machines aren't, at least aren't supposed to be, directly connected to the Internet. And this is good. This is common sense, right? You don't want to plug in a security-critical system to a global network where people can come in from anywhere. However, they're not really as distant from the Internet as they seem. So remember I told you that before every election, the machines have to be programmed with the races and candidates? That data, that programming, has to be created somewhere. And states or localities either create it on a computer workstation that they operate, or they outsource it to vendors, which create the programming. If these election management computers that are used to create the pre-election programming are compromised by attackers, and sometimes these machines are directly connected to the Internet, or they're receiving ballot data by email from counties, it's really a terrible mishmash of vulnerabilities across the country. If you can compromise these computers, well, you can spread a vote-stealing attack on all the memory cards programmed from them and potentially affect results in voting machines over an extremely large area. So how easy is that to do? Well, I'll give you an example. In Michigan, 75% of counties in 2016 outsourced this programming to just two small companies. And we're not talking about security firms. We're talking about companies that are primarily in the business of selling election supplies, ballot boxes, I voted stickers, and so forth. They're not cybersecurity experts as their primary business. Here's the website of one of them. And just looking at their website, it's, I think, about a 20-person company. You get a sense of their security posture. All right, we have all these nice photographs of their facilities and where their computers are and their buildings, stuff that would help an attacker who wanted to physically intrude know where to get in. Or even here, they have their whole company directory online with all of the people and their job titles and email addresses. If I wanted to steal the election in Michigan, well, one thing I might try to do is I could forge an email, and we all know how easy it is to forge and spoof email so it looks like it's coming from someone else. Forge an email to Sue here, the administrative assistant, claiming to be from Larry the president, and I tell her I really urgently need her to change my password. I get into their network. Now I have control. I can spread to the election management system and to the voting machines. This may not be something that everyone can do, but it's the sort of thing that sophisticated criminal attackers are doing all the time. This is the world we live in, where such things are the new kind of crime. All right, there's just one more challenge to our hypothetical attack that's going to swing the result of a national election. And that's that 70% of U.S. votes now are recorded on paper. And paper simply can't be changed after the fact by a cyber attack. All right, so that's great that we're up to 70%, because 10 years ago it was more like 50% of the country used paper. Paper has been significantly on the rise. And the use of paper, I mean, it's just such a common sense thing that in a security critical environment, in a place where computer failures are going to cause massive damage, you want to have a physical failsafe. You want the brakes in your car to still work if the computer goes haywire. In a jet plane, and if you're flying commercially, you have a very fancy satellite and radio navigation system, but you also, by law, have a magnetic compass in that cockpit just in case all the other systems fail. It's a low-cost, common-sense failsafe. Well, paper can serve the same role in elections. And in fact, when we combine it with electronic records, as we do in optical scan voting, for instance, we have this great feature that in order to cheat invisibly, you have to cheat in two different and redundant kinds of records, a set of paper ballots that's expensive to tally completely but is verified by the voter, and an electronic record that's quick to tally but is not directly verified. As long as we audit them to make sure that these sets of records agree and we don't have to trust the computers say so, well, we can have a pretty darn secure system. And the recount effort fundamentally was an attempt to do that, to make sure that the paper records and the electronic records agreed. Now, did we have to do a full recount in order to know that? Well, what we would want if we had time to prepare would be just a statistical sample, basically like taking a poll of those paper records to ask, if we sample enough of the paper, do we see the same winner or not, as we do in the electronic record. But the recounts, because of the pressure of being after the election had actually happened, well, it was there was not a legal vehicle to do a statistical sample like this. There's just one problem with paper. Most states either don't look at enough of it or will never look at any of it, except under extremely unusual circumstances. And the number of states that are doing that will guarantee us today that their laws will conduct a recount robust enough to detect any outcome changing attack. I think we have Colorado so far, which is implementing very rigorous audits this year. Maybe one or two others that have ideal auditing or are close to ideal auditing prescriptions. So, because we don't use the paper, attacks that target the electronic record can succeed without being detected. So where does this leave us? Changing a national election outcome is potentially much easier than we thought, and that is the problem. So just to walk you through it in one slide, the attacker finds the states that are going to determine the outcome, the swing states, scans them all for vulnerabilities, and finds the weakest one. Then the attacker can target the places where the ballot designs are programmed, either county offices or outside vendors. These are not the Fort Knoxes of cybersecurity. Then they can spread vote-stealing attacks to individual machines, the kind of attacks that I and a couple of other grad students developed over a summer years ago. Not rocket science to do this. And then finally, even if the states have paper, unless the states look at enough of it, we'll never know whether the outcome from the electronic records was right. Aye. So, yes. There is a requirement, and I believe it's, is it 21 months?
22 months.
22 months, thank you.
6 months by different states.
It's 22 months, so there's a possibility that if state law provided a mechanism, someone could go back and look at some of it. But quite possibly too late to make a difference. It's after the election has been certified and so forth. In some states, there's just the law does not provide a way to do that, and it really depends. What you want... Yes. Well, I'll come back to what we want. Yeah, let's do a couple of questions now, and then I'll talk about. I'll just have you do one or two more slides.
So, I have two thoughts. One is, what if there was a move to delay the results by say a week?
Mm-hmm.
Would that allow the paper auditing like across the country? Or, I mean, I don't think you can count all 150 million paper ballots in a week.
So I don't actually think we need more time, and that's because you don't have to do a full recount to confirm that the outcome is right. You just have to look at unless it's an extremely close election. So what we want, let me just go to the last slide here where I'm going to talk about what we want to do. And then I'll explain why this works. So let me just finish this with some policy ideas and then answer that and take other questions. So There is not proof yet that any past election has been changed in a cyber attack. And my worry primarily is about the future. We need to do something before an election is definitively changed in a cyber attack. Whether you believe that any past one is correct or incorrect, we know there's a real risk for next time. And so we need to reform our voting infrastructure as a country. There are four main points that I think are essential for this. Hardening the technology and just making sure that state and local offices are doing even small things to elevate their level of security practice. Basic training about passwords and email security for election workers, security scans for state and local systems, code review of voting machines. Not rocket science, once again, but raise the bar for attacks. Second, we need to make sure every vote is recorded on a piece of paper. Simply can't be changed in an attack. Third, we have to use that paper. And the way to use it, and this gets to your question, is in what's called a risk-limiting audit. So this is a statistical way of confirming that the paper and electronic records match by looking at just enough pieces of paper to know that with high confidence, like taking a poll of the paper ballots, as I said. And if the election is decided by one vote, then obviously you have to have people go and look at basically all of the paper to know that. But if it's a landslide, well, if you pull ballots out truly at random, you don't need to look at that many of them to confirm that, well, with very high confidence, it was indeed a landslide. So if we wanted to get high confidence in all important elections, well, we're going to have to do something more efficient, or, as you say, push back by quite a long period the date of certification. But this gives us a way to do it efficiently via statistical sampling, and we don't really have to have a massive change to the dates and timeline.
Yeah, even if it was like 48 hours, I just find that 150 million people show up to vote, and by 1 o'clock in the morning, we all know what happened. And I just find that to be like, give me a break.
Well, you know what? It's probably okay to say this is what it looks like happened, but it's subject to certification. And just like, I don't know, after a horse race, they tell you have to wait a couple of minutes before we're going to confirm who won. We're going to look at the photo.
Yeah. You talked about, the hackers go after the swing state.
Yeah.
So I started a petition to eliminate the Electoral College. About 500,000 signatures when we got the election to move on.
Wow.
Yeah, and so what if the Electoral College was eliminated? Would that, I mean, that would obviously eliminate swing states.
Yeah.
Would that set up, probably pluses and minuses related to the security?
Yes, it does set up pluses and minuses, and it's actually, you're very, It's a very intelligent point. So one effect of the Electoral College is it means that there are some states that basically from the candidate's point of view, maybe they don't matter so much to campaign in. Those same states don't matter that much to hack in, right? Because they're firewalled off in a certain sense. California was not in 2016 going to cast its electoral votes for Donald Trump, and however much it was hacked, people would not accept and believe that outcome. Just because we knew from pre-election polls and other factors this was a state that was not going to do that. If you eliminate the Electoral College, then changing votes anywhere is equally valuable for the attacker. So the attacker now can choose for any jurisdiction across the country to try to strike, and it will have the same effect as if they had previously targeted the most narrow states. On the other hand, it might result in less close elections, which would be very good. It might also, eliminating the Electoral College could be something that would be coupled with better national standards for voting, which could more uniform process and protection of the form I'm speaking about here would give us a lot more reason for confidence everywhere if practiced well. So there are pros and cons. Yes.
What are the tracks that would allow us to detect who hacked the system?
So, in the machines that don't that have paper records, that would determine who So who is a difficult question. Oh, yeah, attribution is a hard problem in security.
The Russians intended to hack our elections, right?
So let me tell you how...
I'm kind of wondering how much validity there is in those claims.
Yeah.
Underlying suspicion.
My own view, and you can interpret the available evidence how you want, because I think we all have access to the same public evidence. I don't have any classified knowledge about this. But my suspicion is that those claims that we're seeing publicly are backed by intercepted communication that is more or less a smoking gun about this. The attribution that the intelligence community makes is not only to Russia, but to the highest levels of the Russian government. And if you're skeptical of all government claims or of all intelligence community claims, that's not going to be worth very much. But if we accept at face value at least what they are saying internally in the documents that they are now prosecuting someone for leaking from the NSA, it sounds like they have some pretty sensitive and high-level intercepts where the Russians are basically ordering people to do some pieces of this. I mean, but Russia is certainly not the only actor that has the capability to do attacks against our voting system. Other hostile nations are building up offensive computer security practices, even sophisticated criminal groups that are engaging in attacks like these ransomware attacks and so forth, increasingly have the technical chops to do something like this.
So the influence is based on influencing voter behavior, right? Rather than attacking into our machine.
We're talking about two different things two different things, both of which apparently happened in 2016. So the influence campaign is pretty well documented, and although still being investigated, and is a major problem. The other problem, though, is that we know attackers, whoever they were, tried to break into election infrastructure. Now the figure, I think 21 states, the Department of Homeland Security says, had their registration systems targeted. One maker of election equipment was broken into, and attackers tried to use them as a launching point to attack local election offices. Those attacks against the election infrastructure itself we don't know how far they got, but so far the trail seems to go cold before you get to the voting machines, but we don't know. And no one has done the kind of investigation that would tell us with confidence whether the voting machines also were targeted. It's purely from sources other than, if there is reason to believe it, it's coming from something other than people having gone and looked at the voting machines themselves because, well, the government hasn't done that. They admit that they haven't done forensics of the actual voting machines and equipment.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I have a question about paper ballots.
Yes.
A lot of people don't ever check that the paper ballot agrees with what they put on the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, do you need a lot of people, or does it just take one or two people to say, I haven't put this machine...
Well, you're getting right at the reason why that second style of voting machines, the DRE touchscreens with a VVPAT, a printout, aren't really the preferred style for the election integrity community, the preferred style of voting. We much rather prefer that voters fill out a piece of paper themselves, and then they have directly confirmed that it contains what they marked on it. There's abundant research that many voters will not notice errors on a printout record, which is unfortunate. If we, in places that use that style really should switch to optical scan. Although, even in the absence of that, it does provide better protection than none because some voters will notice errors. And if the voter complaints about that are cataloged, and are investigated and anyone pays attention, that gives you some hope of discovering it, but we have to actually have a good process in place to follow up on such complaints. Yes.
Yes, I totally agree on the idea of more paper, and I think that's essential. But something that we haven't been talking about and nationally, and we've begun talking locally in Pennsylvania about, are the very reliable non-electronic mechanical machines, like the old...
The lever machines, yes. I'm from Pennsylvania, and that's how I voted when I started to vote,
right.
Yeah.
And I serve as a judge of election, too, so I've seen over the years that when those machines are maintained, they are very accurate. Tampering is easily detected. We've had convictions in my home county because of tampering. So might you want to address that as a possibility?
So I agree with you. There's something appealingly physical about the lever machines, that they don't have a computer that is running invisible code, that someone in principle can inspect them and know whether the mechanism is working the way it should. And I think that's a plus. On the other hand, I think there are reasons why that style of voting machine probably isn't something we should return to. The primary reason being there is no permanent record created by that machine of each person's vote. It's just the state of the gears in the back of the machine, right? So if you want, there is also nothing to recount or to audit in lever machines, unfortunately. If the machine is... if the machine is even momentarily not under lock and key, you never have the ability to go back and get confidence in the result. So I think they had their era, but let's go a little bit farther back to actual pieces of paper.
And write-ins are very difficult.
Oh, yeah, I remember that too. Yes, sir.
You know, we got the 2018-2020 election coming up, and of course a lot of us were activists, been doing this for many, many years. I've been doing it since 2004 full-time. We see this constant shift. We see how the insider is involved in my state. I caught one guy who was programming on a 1099, 13 out of 15 counties. He was loading the databases through telephone phone modems, the same ones that received. So basically,
oh my goodness.
He was a kingpin. And then, of course, I was with Bev Harris, the Fraction Magic team, that disclosed that there's 5,000 possible insiders in this country who could hack elections. And just like you said, it's targeted. Now I'm in a situation, I used to be an election integrity activist. I'm no longer an integrity activist. The system has no integrity. I want transparency.
An
ET now, okay?
Yeah.
And now we're in a situation the country is shifting to new optical scanners that create actual ballot images, and if we fight hard enough, we can make sure they can marry the ballot images to the original ballot, use Dr. Phil Stark's method of random checking, or you could download the ballots by precinct on your own computer. You can have an app and you can count it yourself. Now this is all possible because these records are public records. They're not the unique ballot. They are copies. And by the way, they have to be preserved because they're in the chain of custody. In my court case in Arizona, the judge asked Pima County this. If you take photocopies, not a computer guy, he says, if you take photocopies of ballots and then you use the photocopies to count, what makes you think you can destroy them? They were destroying all of them in Arizona, 11 out of 15 counties. In Ohio, 13 counties were destroying images. And these images could now be married to the original. That's the solution. That is what election transparency is about. And so any thoughts on that on your own? Or?
Yeah, so let me say that I applaud your efforts to increase transparency here, and I think transparency in getting more people involved in the process of knowing that our election results are right is absolutely essential. I think the ballot images, that can help. The main thing is that it's not really an either-or between those images and Phil Stark's statistical sampling. You need to do both.
Absolutely.
Because it's actually not that hard to write a computer algorithm that would Photoshop ballot images en masse. That's something that's probably a good project for one of my undergrads in my security class.
These ballots are unique. They're hand-marked.
Yeah, no, I don't
but
buy it.
But you still got to go to the original where they got to be married.
I don't buy it that it's difficult to do that. But if you check that, you sample those ballot images and go and pull the pieces of paper to make sure that didn't happen, then you have a nice system. But that's an essential step. It's not an, it can't be an either or. All right. Passing on to Jill. Thank you all.
So I'm going to fill in some of the space around what Alex presented, and it's been a real pleasure to be working with Alex over the last year almost. It seems like it's been going on forever, and the recount still lives, by the way. It's not something that is over and done. So I'm going to sort of pull back and talk about some of the broader issues of election integrity, and as was just pointed out, we don't have election integrity in lots of ways. What is the opposite of election integrity? It's election corruption. And election corruption itself is a microcosm of political corruption. And the two seem to be going hand in hand. And that is especially reflected in what's going on right now in Philadelphia in the lawsuit that's being brought in the race that Sherry Honkola ran, which is she ran for state representative in the machine Democratic town of Philadelphia. And what went on in that race is just a textbook of political corruption, including election corruption. So I just want to make that point that what we're looking at in our elections is part of a bigger crisis of democracy. And what we're fighting for with the recount is it's one of the few tools that we have in elections for creating accountability and transparency. If you can't recount, you've basically handed a license to commit fraud to people who are capable of doing it. You're saying, we're not going to check. There is no there's no accountability mechanism here. And, you know, people are, they think of a recount as something special, you know, like that we need a special license in order to conduct a recount. Recounts should actually be built into the process. We should have the capacity, basically, to do audits all the time, which are sort of like mini recounts. They should be built into the process, and we should have the ability to do a broader recount if there are red flags, if there are concerns about the election. And just to give an example of how it could be done differently, in the country of Austria last year, there was an election for president. The election results began to be counted a little bit before the election was over. So some people cried foul, and that those early results potentially influenced the voting that was still going on. There happened to be a green candidate for president who actually won that election. So in calling for a recount, they were basically saying, well, you know, we can't just give this away to the green who won that election. Not only did Austria recount the election, they actually held an entire revote to make sure that the whole process was clean. And in fact, the green candidate won the election by an even larger margin where the revote was held. Another example is that after the chaos of our election, the country of the Netherlands said, we don't want that kind of chaos. We think that we might, you know, be subject to the same disruption. So they then instituted, on just a couple weeks' notice, they did a paper ballot vote. They did away with their electronic machines. They did a paper ballot vote, which was counted then by hand. And yes, it takes time and it takes some resources, but you know, I'd be very interested to see the actual breakout of full costs when you include the costs of voting machines and their maintenance and their reprogramming and their replacement every, you know, few years and so on. It'd be really interesting to see how that breaks down. There are a couple of communities in the U.S. that are doing hand counts of their ballots, and some of them are really enthusiastic about it, about how it creates a whole public process in which young people come out, they're trained, they do the counting, all political parties are there observing. It creates a real public process around counting the votes. So I just want to put it out there that, you know, there are other ways to do this, and, you know, it's just important, I think, to keep an open mind about how we can change this process, understanding that we have a real crisis in our electoral system. And that crisis is both a crisis of cybersecurity, and I'm so thankful to have someone like Alex who's been working on this for a long time, who's been ahead of the curve, and now the curve is catching up to him, and people are taking interest, especially at this time that we are seeing a crisis of cybersecurity in many other aspects of society. You've all heard about the ransomware crises. Does that ring a bell to people? The WannaCry crisis. Basically, this malware that was widely diffused, and lots of people got tricked into clicking on it. And it basically, it shuts down your data on your computer, on your personal computer or a company computer or hospital computer, energy sector computers, banking computers. It was many sectors of society and over 100 countries around the world. There have been two episodes with this ransomware, pointing out that we have a cybersecurity crisis really in all aspects of society. And it's not credible, you know, in my view, to say that, oh, we have a cybersecurity crisis everywhere, and it's affecting many aspects of our election system, and that's been well documented, but it's not affecting our voting machines. You know, is that credible that somehow everything around the bank is being robbed, but the crooks are staying away from the bank when the bank has no defenses either? It's just hard to believe. And the powers that be are very quick to say, well, there's absolutely no evidence ever that the system has been hacked. But there's also been no examination of the evidence ever as to whether the system has been hacked or not. So the absence of proof is not the proof of absence. We may not have any direct evidence of voting machine software, or vote reporting software being hacked, but we just haven't looked. And that's why we're trying to do this in the recount, and we are still actively trying to get our hands on those machines. We have an active case that's working its way through the courts in Pennsylvania. We are in dialogue with the state of Wisconsin about that material as well, because it is actually public record. We have a right to it. We're working our way through that system. So we hope to find out. You know, there's a saying that, you know, sunshine is the best, what is it?
Disinfectant.
Thank you. Yes. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. We were told when we were doing the recount, you know, how dare you? Aren't you undermining confidence in our voting system? Well, somehow they missed the reality that that confidence has long gone out the window. Last spring, long before the recount, last spring of 2015, there was a poll done by the AP NORC polling agencies, You can look it up. You can Google it. And what they found was that 9 out of 10 Americans have lost confidence in our political system, in all aspects. 9 out of 10. And that was even before the chaos, of the actual election itself. Since the election itself, you know, there's been all this contention, around election systems. You know, we both have this crisis of cybersecurity, but there's also a real crisis of confidence in our elections themselves. And you have Donald Trump saying it was voter fraud, when in fact it's exactly the opposite. It's fraud that's been perpetrated on voters in many ways. So the issues of voting machines, their accuracy and security is one aspect of that crisis. But the other aspect of that crisis, and it's important that we not, that we not ignore it, and in fact that we connect with it, and that is this crisis around voter ID laws and interstate cross-check, because we know that hundreds of thousands and potentially millions of voters are being denied the vote as well. So our votes are under attack through an insecure voting system that could be flipping votes or eliminating votes. But even before you get into the voting booth, our votes are very much under attack. And we know that those numbers are enormous. And it's important that we not be divided and conquered as a movement. We need a, in my view, we need a unified movement for voting justice that includes all of those pieces. And we've really worked to do that during the course of the recount so that we have, you know, we have the critical mass that it takes. It takes critical mass in order to push a government, especially a government of by and for the 1%. It takes real work to get it to do the right thing. And you can go there and educate them. I hesitate to say how many decades of my life thinking that I could just tell the truth to power and that we would go there and lobby them. Well, the reality is if you want lobbying to work, you got to go with millions of dollars in your pocket. That's how lobbying works. Lobbying is not a citizen's endeavor. So really important that we build a whole movement around this. So with that said, let me just run through a couple of broad brushstroke points, and then we'll open this up for questions. The point here, you know, to the recount, in my view, is that we deserve a voting system that we can trust, which is accurate, secure, and just, and which is free from Jim Crow in our elections. This was one of the very surprising revelations of the recount. And the recount wasn't able to reveal much because it got shut down. The biggest thing that the recount revealed was that the system is not friendly to a recount, is extremely hostile to the idea that it should be transparent or accountable, which does make you wonder, why is it that way? You know, is it strictly turf issues? Is it just kind of, you know, protecting the sense of dignity of that sector, or is there something else going on that is more systematic and not so innocent? But one of the other things that we did find out before we were shut down was that the system fails, and it fails with a bias towards failing in under-resourced communities. So this was exemplified in Detroit, where there were some 84, 87, something like that, optical scanners that failed. Where did they fail? They failed basically in communities of color that did not have the budgets that it takes in order to keep these machines up to date and well maintained and so on. So all the errors that can happen with a technology-dependent system are going to be more likely to happen in communities of color. And this validated statistics that had been put out by the U.S. Voting Commission some years back, saying that the odds that your vote is going to get thrown away or altered or changed or something like that go up 900% inside of communities of color. So even inside of this little universe, that focuses on the technology of voting, still we found that the issues of voting justice and of Jim Crow were very much alive and well. And findings like that, and in Wisconsin, for example, in Wisconsin it was the low-income communities of color that were denied a hand recount. The rest of the state recounted simply by inserting the ballots back into the same machines that might have been misprogrammed to start with. Making the point that there are real issues of justice here, and it's important for us to connect along that dimension of justice in order for us to build a movement that can fix the voting system and create voting justice in all of its dimensions. And then just to quote Judge Mark Goldsmith, if you can just see that at the bottom of the slide there, who was one of the federal judges in Michigan, he recognized that the recount is essential to the right to vote, and because if you can't recount it, you have absolutely no way to determine whether it is accurate, whether there has been fraud or malfeasance or just human or machine error. You can't tell. That recounts are essential to ensure fair and accurate elections, and that is the bedrock of democracy. And, you know, it's clear that bedrock of democracy has gone missing in so many ways. So the effort to get that recount to happen is really important because, again, you know, sunshine is a critical disinfectant. Confidence had long been lost already in the voting system, and by looking at what happened, not the whole thing, but even pieces of it, it's really important if we are going to try to recreate confidence in this voting system. Let's see. So this is just to make the point that there are many components to that voting system. And in particular, I'm focusing here on the machines, the optical scanners, and the voting machines themselves, and then voter registration. And then out of that comes a vote count, and then elected officials. So we tend to focus, in the discussion of election integrity, we tend to focus on the scanners and the voting machines. And this is just the point that I made before, but there are many other ways, like through suppressing voters, ID laws, voter intimidation, stripping the rolls. And then there's the whole political vote suppression, too, that is by denying voters a reason to come to the polls and, you know, access to the ballot for independent voices and third parties. That's denied as well. Money in politics, corporate media, debate exclusion, and fear-based voting, the notion that you have to vote for the lesser evil. We don't, you know, all of that is subject to remedy. That stuff can be fixed. So there are many ways in which voting integrity and voting justice is suppressed. And again, there are lots of elements of electronics in our voting system. It's not only the voting machines and the optical scanners. It's how the votes get tallied. It's how the votes then get reported up to higher levels of the election system. The voter registration systems themselves are, you know, it's a database which is dependent on software. And as Alex was saying, we know that at least 21 states got hacked into. And how did we find out about that? That was really interesting. If this is at least the story as I've heard it. Alex, you may know more about this than I do. I'm sure you do. But someone in Illinois, as I understood, an IT consultant was sitting there in the voter registry doing some kind of work with their database, and he noticed that the database was being manipulated, that it had been hacked into. He then reported that to the FBI, that basically the Illinois voter database was infected. The FBI then contacted voter registration officials in many states, and many of them wanted to work with the FBI. They began looking into it and discovered that 21 of them, at least, had been hacked into. The point I want to make there is that voter registration is a system that we interact with. Human beings interact with it. Human beings don't throughout the year, we're not interacting with our voting machines for the most part. Whereas voter registration, we're constantly, human beings are constantly eyeballing it and working with it. That's why the hack was discovered. We're not constantly eyeballing and working with our voting machines or the optical scanners and our reporting software and all that. So we're not interacting with it. So unless, it's like if you get a diagnosis of cancer, you want to then know if that cancer has spread. So that's what goes on in a medical workup. You know, you get an X-ray of your, you know, or a CT scan or an MRI of your liver and your lungs and your brain. You sample the other critical systems to find out whether they have been subject to the spread of that cancer. We're not doing that in our voting system. We are taking great pains not to look at the actual voting machines themselves. And the other critical software. And as Alex was pointing out before, if you get in, and we know from the leaked data from the NSA, the NSA leaked someone at the NSA leaked a report, and that report documented a hack into private software companies. And that was then found to have jumped from the software companies to local election officials. And it's documented that that happened. And the local election officials on their computers, they interface with everything else. So once you get malware there, it can go anywhere. Have they really avoided, you know, given the open nature of the system, all the doors that are wide open, have the hackers, whether it's Russians, whether it's gangsters, whether it is, you know, partisans, political partisans here in this country, have they all avoided these open doors within the system and not gone there? We deserve to know. That system needs to be examined to find out. So, again, this just shows what we know has been hacked, all right? So we know that this whole line from software companies to voter registration to the actual databases, the software to the databases, that's all been hacked, and we know election officials have been hacked. That very well could be, but we don't know, and we deserve to know. A couple other quick points. This is not a Democratic or Republican issue. Many people have said, oh, that recount, it was just a tool of the Democrats. Well, in fact, the states that were chosen before at least two out of three were known to have a winner. They were extremely close elections, and they were targeted because they had red flags. Those red flags were very close elections. Ultimately, it was that the election outcome was different from the exit polls, which was also different from the polls prior to the election, and that there were electronic vulnerabilities, like in Pennsylvania, where the voting machines don't have a paper trail. And again, resistance to the recount on all sides, frivolous legal obstruction, administrative hurdles, like in Pennsylvania, where you had to get three voters from every one of 9,000 districts in order to file a notarized petition, and they all had to do it by a certain date, which was unknown and unknowable, by a date at a location that you had no idea where it was. So you had to fulfill all these impossible criteria in order, and 27,000 people had to do this in order to have a recount. So, you know, impossible hurdles, financial hurdles like in Wisconsin, where the cost of the recount was going to be $1 million, and we started fundraising for it, and then we learned, oops, no, it's not going to be $1 million, it's going to be $3.5 million. And the price changed, like, in 24 hours, just as we were, you know, sort of gearing up to try to do it. So it really seemed like this system did not want to be held accountable. And, you know, if you followed the news while it was going on, every effort was made to, smear the recount and to render it, you know, just, you know, a really underhanded, nasty kind of thing. Why in the world would they want to do that? Since the recount, you know, all this evidence has continued to accumulate that our voting system is wide open and extremely vulnerable to attack, to manipulation, to machine and human error, etc. And somehow the media has managed not to connect the dots here and realize that there's still a recount lawsuit going on. We could actually find out. The myth is out there that there is evidence that our votes are just fine. Everything is just fine. But that's only the absence of evidence that they are misinterpreting to be proof that everything is fine. No, they haven't looked. It's easy to say you don't have a problem as long as you don't ask the question and actually look to see whether or not the system is problematic. I mentioned about Jim Crow in our elections. and the solutions Alex went over before. And then I'll just add that there are reputable cybersecurity people out there, like William Biney, who was the head of the NSA when they established their data collection, their automated data collection systems, a guy who knows a lot about cybersecurity. He thinks that the evidence is not there. And there are others, too. I'm not saying that we do or don't have it, but rather that the evidence that's been put forward is considered by some cybersecurity people as extremely circumstantial. And, you know, that evidence was basically gathered by CrowdStrike, a private cybersecurity firm that was investigating the leak or hack, whatever it was, of the DNC information, the DNC emails, which created all the furor. So CrowdStrike was brought in by the Democratic Party. There are also questions about CrowdStrike's professionalism and their credibility that have been raised by many people. So they had a conflict of interest. They were working for the Democratic Party, and they have a questionable reputation. Why did our own security agencies not address this question? And why did the DNC refuse to allow access to their server? So their server has not yet been examined. There are just funny things surrounding this that suggest the end of the story is not yet in front of us. So I try to separate out the question of who done it, which, you know, we've really tried to do throughout the recount. We try to separate out the question of who did it, because whether the Russian government did it, Russian oligarchs, hackers, gangsters, or domestic partisans, or our private software companies in this country, which are also extremely political and have skin in the game politically, it doesn't matter. They're all trying to get in. As we are, well, I can't say for sure, but we know that hacking is the reality right now. You can see that writ large in the ransomware crisis that's happened. Hacking is the order of the day. The president of Microsoft, Brad Smith, recently proposed that we hold a Geneva Convention for cybersecurity. And many countries have proposed that we actually undertake an international treaty to stop hacking, to stop cyber warfare, that it needs to be approached on a large level because it is so endemic. This is the way the system works right now. So pending that broader solution, and sanctions, by the way, do not protect the system. They may slap somebody's wrist, but I think there are lots of wrists out there to be slapped, including the CIA, because where did the ransomware crisis come from? They built it. The CIA created this backdoor into Microsoft by spying on Microsoft. They created the hack into Microsoft, which then got leaked and taken up by various criminal elements, and we had a worldwide crisis around it. So everybody's doing it. We're doing it too. We need to end it with an international treaty, but in the meantime, we need to protect our elections. And as Alex was saying, it's not rocket science how to do that. It's pretty straightforward. We need paper ballots. We need good statistical risk-limiting audits. We need cybersecurity best practices, and we need easy, readily available recounts when there's need to do them. And this needs to be linked to the broader movement for voting justice. What good does it have to have perfect machines when people are being stripped by the millions from getting into the voting booth and casting their vote? And it's important that we not, allow ourselves to be divided into these different sectors of fighting for voting justice. They're all connected, and this is the democracy we deserve. We're only going to get it by fighting for it and by fighting for it together. So thank you for being here and being part of that fight. We only have a few minutes for questions. Apologies for that, but, I want to open this up to Alex and myself as well. So your thoughts, questions? Yep.
Yeah, I'm fairly new to this, so others might know it a little bit better. But following the elections, especially in the primaries, I noticed discrepancies between exit polls and what was actually the final result.
Yes.
And I didn't take screenshots. I wasn't prepared to store the evidence. But after the election happened, I couldn't find it anymore. it seemed to me that exit polls are used as an indication of the validity of the election process.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, what happened there? Is there any way to sort of bring that back into public light?
And let me just say, you make a really good point, because while all the data in the general election, the close election, the flipped results, the red flags, like huge numbers of what are called undervotes, where the ballot did not have a vote for president. I mean, it was really weird. Those numbers were way up in certain states. Those red flags all wound up being in Republican states, but during the primaries, there were just red flags waving all over the place in the Democratic states. And that too, begs for investigation. If you Google Robert Fitrakis, he's done a number of articles about sort of the weird stuff going on in the primary. And you're absolutely right. And that should be every bit as much a subject of discussion and investigation. And it points the finger very much at the Democratic machine, as does the business in Philadelphia right now as well. So it is a multi-partisan issue. And at the end of the day, it's not about candidates who are being cheated. It's about voters who are being cheated. Yeah.
So, Alex had suggested the power of having decentralized voting systems, state by state, local counties and stuff. But I'm wondering, these simple fixes that you guys discussed, what about some federal guidelines? What about a bill? Is there any, like pass a bill to, get these things across the country?
Absolutely.
They're pretty simple, and what about federal legislation?
Well, I can speak to that a little bit, because I've been spending quite a bit of time in Washington this summer trying to educate people on the Hill about these issues, and I gave a congressional briefing a couple of months ago where I gave a similar talk. I was invited in June, I guess, to testify to the Senate Intelligence Committee about threats to the election system. So I think there is building interest in Washington to try to address this problem. Our system, our election system differs very heavily to the states, especially for the details of election administration, although Congress does have constitutional authority to set time, place, and manner for federal elections, so there's potentially legal authority there. I think the main thing, though, that's working in favor of election legislation right now is that it's become a national security issue and a cybersecurity issue in addition to all of the other things about basic democratic process that this represents. So I'm increasingly optimistic that we're going to see some federal legislation to try to address the problem. It may not be in the form of immediate strong standards, but maybe at least some incentives or cost-sharing to try to help the states replace their obsolete equipment, coupled with some encouragement to adopt better auditing practices. If Congress, the main impediments right now are the just amount of political ill will in Washington and the inability of Congress to do anything. But I hope if there's anything that Congress can overcome those to act on, yeah, it's the basic integrity of our democratic system.
Yeah, great. And I would encourage you, if you want to stay, I mean, there are many voting integrity groups that you can stay in touch with. You can also stay in touch with us and with the recount effort, by signing up for the email list at jill2016.com, because you'll get the news of the recount through those email updates every 2 weeks or so.
Is there any kind of talk about another HABA coming out and before the 2020? Because, you know, Georgia, all these states with these DREs, it's all the news all the time. Any news that you've heard?
I think there are a lot of people who in Congress who would like to write legislation, and it's a question about whether Republicans and Democrats will come together to support something. HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, right back after the Bush versus Gore fiasco, gave the states about $2 billion to buy new equipment. So much of that money was wasted because there were not adequate standards.
Okay.
So I'm not sure that HAVA is exactly the right model or what we'd want to see happen, but the very high level idea of federal cost sharing to help the states with election administration, coupled with some better standards. There are a lot of questions. How would you develop those standards? Are they going to be adequate? But I think there is an opportunity, and there is a lot of interest in Washington. So one other thing to do is to contact your elected representatives and let them know that this is an important issue.
In the interest of time, you know, people who want to stay after and have further discussion, we can do that, but why don't we formally conclude right now. So thank you all for being here. Thank you so much to Alex.
Thank you.
So feel free to stick around if you have some time, but also feel free to move on to your next session.